to call this session on reliability of computer systems to order, and I'd like to begin by briefly discussing just a little bit of an overview of our six papers in the session, and I will then turn the meeting over to our first speaker. Now, as most of you will have seen, we have revised the session such that there will be a panel discussion at the end of the session, which will be conducted by the various members of the panel. I would like you to forward, sometime during this session, written questions to me. And I hope during that panel session to select and group the written questions. I would also hope that there are some experts in the audience who will be able to help us answer some of the questions. And during the panel session, if there is someone who has something to contribute, please come up to one of the floor mics and so that I can recognize you and you can join in with the panel in answering some of the questions. The four papers represented here and two, which are printed in the back of the proceedings, cover both the subjects of hardware and software. It's a little difficult to separate them at an overall level. However, I think you'll find that each author has addressed himself to one or the other topics. I think we'll find that during our discussion session, many of the questions will cut across lines and discuss interaction of computer hardware and software. There will be a replacement of the paper listed in the program by Mr. Jerwitz of Saab Scandia by Mr. Mullock. Now, I urge you, though, to read this paper by Mr. Jerwitz. This is something that I would call his paper entitled The Reliability Program of the Airborne CK-37. That's a Swedish Air Force airborne computer. I would call this classical reliability, and I mean that in the good sense. He has gone through and done a classical reliability analysis in a very fine way. He arrives at predictions, he arrives at numbers for failure rates of components, and his estimate and his test results agree within, not too many percent. So it looks like a very good job, and I hope you'll read this. The paper by Ed Jordan on reliability of real-time computer systems. Mr. Jordan is also overseas at the time. He's in Australia, and he won't be able to present his paper. And Dr. Herb Hecht will be presenting his paper instead. Now, I urge you to read also Mr. Jordan's paper. He discusses some data on computer system hardware and software failures. He also discusses the concepts of system crashes, hard crashes and soft crashes. In other words, if the system does come down, you can very quickly push a button and come back into operation. It's not nearly so severe as if there are many minutes or even hours interim during which you have to reload the whole system. And I think you'll find that an interesting discussion. I recommend that you read that when you have an opportunity. I would like to begin our schedule. We're a little bit behind schedule, but we'll try and stick as well as we can to schedule so that there will be ample time for our discussion session. And our first speaker of a multiple authored paper will be Major John Hesse. He will be speaking on quantitative models for software reliability. Major Hesse's background began at a very well-known university on the East Coast. In 1956, he received a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering at Brooklyn Polytech. You'll hear that name mentioned again before I'm through, and it turns out, partially by coincidence, that three of our speakers were all associated with Brooklyn Poly at one time or other. After he finished his degree at Brooklyn Poly, he spent 3 years in the research department at Revere Copper and Brass, then began a succession of assignments with the U.S. Army. He was with the Army Ordnance School faculty from 59 through 60. He was attending while on his Army career, New Mexico State University, and in 1965 he finished up a master's degree in mechanical engineering, and in 1966 an SCD, both from New Mexico State. He spent a tour of duty at Lawrence Radiation Lab, and his present assignment is with Safeguard. He has been chief of the Operational Reliability Branch, and at present he is with the MSR Weapon System Processor, which means software. John?
Now, I have the first slide, please. As increasingly stringent reliability requirements are placed on large systems with a significant software component, more attention is being given by both users and developers to the subject of software reliability. Most work documented thus far has concentrated, however, on formal code verification techniques and has not really addressed the question of software reliability in a quantitative system analysis context. The work described here is an effort to address that question. Our objectives were first to extend probabilistic methods of reliability analysis into the realm of software development, such that they would be applicable to large software programs. Second, to apply the analysis derived to a preliminary base of data collected on existing large software packages. And third, to suggest a framework for further data collection to include all variables necessary to remove the assumptions that we were forced to make in our basic analysis. In order to start our work, we must propose a number of qualitative working definitions of terms. First, let us define software reliability as the probability that a given software program operates for some time period without a software-induced error on the machine for which it was designed, given that it is used within design limits. Let us further define software errors as deficiencies in fidelity, veracity, or viability, which lead either to a system crash or an unacceptable degradation in system performance. Fidelity is the accuracy with which an algorithm is mechanized for a given operating and hardware system. Veracity is the adequacy with which a given algorithm represents the requirements of the physical world, while viability is the adequacy with which the mechanization of an algorithm meets any existing real-time constraints. We imply here error detection as execution or results detection of errors. We will define a large program as one which is very complex and/or interactive with a large number of instructions. Exhaustive testing of such a program is not normally economically feasible. Hence, we may expect that it will contain residual errors in all phases of its life cycle. A small program, then, is defined as limited in complexity, particularly in the number of branch or jump statements. Exhaustive testing for such a program is normally feasible. We have identified four phases of the life cycle of a large software package. In the design phase, equations and algorithms are designed, flowcharts are prepared, and subroutines or groups of subroutines are written, tested, and integrated iteratively. This phase terminates with the first system assembly of all code. During the development phase, code is assembled, tested, and debugged pending initial release to the user. During the user test phase, use testing of programs occurs to uncover and correct residual errors surviving the development phase. This phase will then terminate as user complaints to the developer become tolerably infrequent. The operational phase includes a period where residual errors are infrequently uncovered and may not be fixed when found. During this final phase, management must balance the cost of error correction against the intangible costs of user dissatisfaction. Proceeding with the development of our error model, let us assume that configuration control procedures are implemented during the development phase and continue into the user test phase. One datum collected should represent coding changes per instruction per unit time and could be graphically represented as a histogram, where rho of tau equals the error detection rate per instruction per unit time. The model selected to represent this function should, of course, be selected by an examination of the data. Given an error detection rate, we may then define the cumulative error function epsilon of tau as the integral from 0 to tau of rho of x dx, where tau is defined as calendar time. I make a distinction here of calendar time with operating time on the equipment. Let us then assume that all errors detected will be corrected, that the total number of instructions, I sub t, is fixed and finite, and that functional corrections do not introduce new errors. These assumptions will be discussed in more detail later in the presentation. Given these assumptions, the residual errors epsilon sub r of tau will be given by the total errors per instruction minus the corrected errors per instruction as shown in the last equation on this slide. In our generalized development of reliability relations, we will define capital T as the random variable time to failure, where T begins at time of run start, and derive the standard probability functions used in reliability work, i.e., the reliability function R of T, the failure function F of T, the density function small f of T, and the hazard or failure rate function Z of T. The reliability function is defined as the probability of success up to time T. Thus, the failure function, or probability of failure before time t, is given by 1 minus r of t. The first derivative of the failure function with respect to t is the probability density function for time to failure, also equal to minus the first derivative with respect to time of the reliability function. The probability of failure in time interval delta t, given no previous failure, is then equal to the hazard function z of t times delta t, and is also equal to the density function small f of t times delta t divided by the reliability function. These relationships are illustrated on this slide. Note that capital T, again, represents runtime or operating time for a particular software package, in contradistinction to tau, which represents calendar time. By manipulating these relationships, we may derive an equation relating the reliability function R of T to the hazard function Z of T. Substituting the initial condition that the reliability at time zero is defined as unity, then yields an expression for reliability as the exponential of the negative integral over operating time of the hazard function. In order to construct our specific reliability model, we will let small t equal system operating hours, replacing the variable capital T used in the generalized development. The hazard function z of tau will then be chosen from an examination of data to represent the hazard or failure rate over calendar time. The probability of failure in some time interval delta t is proportional to the probability of an error in any instruction multiplied by the number of unique instructions processed in the interval delta t. The constant of proportionality k is introduced to account in some very approximate manner for the ratio of catastrophic errors detected to errors, total errors detected, and roughly scales the effect of an instructional error on program success. R sub p is the symbol we have chosen for the number of unique instructions processed per hour. In other words, the rate of processing. Substituting our previously derived equation for the number of residual errors, epsilon sub r of tau, into the equation just given for failure rate or hazard, we may write the equation shown on this slide for hazard z of tau. The reliability function r of t is then obtained from previously derived expressions. This equation will predict the probability of no errors during the user test phase. We should note that in performing the required integration, small t was defined as a small subset of calendar time tau, so that we could conveniently treat it as a constant during the integration. Collecting terms in the reliability equation and noting that mean time between failure is defined as the integral from 0 to infinity of t f of t dt, in some generalized sense, we may then write the expression for mean time between failure in terms of our reliability expression, as indicated on this slide. That slide off, please. In order to test the theory developed, data have been collected from developers of large software packages designed to operate on third-generation computer equipment. The actual time range for the user test phase of our data sources lay between 5 and 13 months. All data represented in this presentation and in the paper are proprietary, and hence I cannot identify them with specific sources. All developers are, however, well known and hopefully of good repute within the data processing industry. Since we wish to construct a predictive database, we divided our data into two major categories: supervisory programs and application or executive programs. The basis for this was a slightly different observed shape for the raw correction data as a function of time. In order to derive a composite database, all data were normalized to a 6-month user test interval by a simple scaling technique based on maintenance of the area under the histogram of changes per unit time and upon retention of the relationship between time interval elements. We should note that raw data which were collected in terms of programmatic changes per unit time have been divided by 17 instruction changes per programmatic change. Again, a datum collected from our data sources. This figure shows changes per month as a composite normalized to a 6-month time interval for 3 supervisory programs containing 210,000, 230,000, and 240,000 instructions, respectively, per program, rounded to the nearest thousand. The triangular model fitted is based on data points plotted at the midpoint of the time interval with the curve constrained by a least squares technique to pass through 0 at time 0 and time 6 months. This assumes an artificial cessation of activity between phases in the life cycle. We may now substitute into previously derived expressions for residual errors as a function of calendar time and reliability as a function of operating time in order to develop quantitative expressions for hazard and reliability for the data shown. These, then, lead to mean time between failure. For the supervisory composite database, the function for mean time between failure assumes the shape indicated on this curve. Note that significant improvement in the mean time between failure occurs in the normalized time interval between 4 and 5 months, or in the 60 to 80% complete debug time frame. This analysis process was repeated for 4 large application programs, each nominally of 240,000 instructions, to derive the hazard model shown on this slide and the mean time between failure function as indicated on the next slide. May I have the next slide, please? It is clear that several significant assumptions have been made in this development, which could be verified if data were collected by developers on the following specific items. 1, coding changes per unit time divided into those changes made to assure functional adequacy and those changes that were made for cleanup purposes. 2, the percentage of instructions vital to program success. 3, the number of new errors introduced per correction. 4, the correction success rate, and last, the number of instruction changes per programmatic change. Data on these items will permit a somewhat more rigorous development of the theory. Our basic plea with this paper and with my presentation is for sound, comprehensive configuration control, beginning in the development phase and continuing through the user test and operational phases. This is equally applicable to government and industry, and should have benefits in the area of development management, specifically in determination of resource requirements, the effect of reliability on schedules, and the cost of the effort. Since software costs are now comparable with hardware costs in many state-of-the-art systems, trade-offs of testing against the reliability methodology presented we believe to be essential. The methods suggested here await more data for further validation, extension, and application. May I answer any questions?
Question up front here, please. Please go to the microphone for the questions and identify yourself and your organization.
Bernie Tiger. I think this might be a pretty basic question. I think you're doing a very good job of trying to relate software reliability with hardware reliability and parallel the definitions. But my question is a very simple and basic one. An equipment or a system, it works or it doesn't work. Your random variable is whether or not it performs within specified limits. Now, just what is your random variable in software? Is it whether or not the programmer wrote the instruction correctly? Do you understand my question?
Let me take a whack at it. I had defined three things that I felt that a program had to do, and I called them fidelity, veracity, and viability.
Right.
And errors in any of those three could conceivably be catastrophic to the success of the integrated hardware-software package.
Mm-hmm.
So really, we are looking for failure of this package to operate within requirements in any of those three areas.
So a failure, then, is whether or not an instruction is written correctly?
That is a possibility. That's one of several.
Yes.
I could, for example, let's say that I wanted to derive an equation relating velocity and time. I could conceivably, A, write down the wrong equation.
Right.
I could, B, insert some exponent when I coded it accidentally. Or perhaps my problem really wasn't to relate velocity and time in the first place. So I could perhaps choose entirely the wrong representation of the physical world.
Yeah, this is what I thought. So when you're talking about error rates associated with software, it isn't whether an instruction is correct or not. An instruction is either correct or not correct. The programmer either programmed correctly or didn't program correctly. I'm having trouble grasping exactly what your random variable is. I could see, like, if you have a group of programmers, a mathematician, they've get together, they've been writing programs, so you can get a data. But really, what you got is they're the random variable, whether what percentage of the time they write a correct statement or not. In that sense, you have a real concrete meaning there.
Well, I'm taking a little higher level approach to it. I'm looking at it from system success point of view rather than as the software package as an entity. I don't think I've answered your question.
No, right, I'm talking system. I mean, you got statistical terms, and you got definitions, you got probabilities, and the random variable needs an exact.
Are you really asking me why I'm applying a probabilistic approach to something that might seem deterministic? Is this the
that may be part of it, but it's a very straightforward question. Just what is the random variable that you're saying there's a probability?
Time to system failure.
This is right.
Time to system failure.
Right. It's the probability of the software contributing or causing the
That's
system
right.
failure.
In other words, you punch a button, a large system with hardware and software both operating, starts operating, it fails.
Right.
If you trace that failure to software, then your random variable is the time to software failure. If you trace it to hardware, then you're talking about the time to hardware failure. Those two random variables relate to the third random variable, which is the time to system
failure. Well, that's a clear statement. Now, when you're dealing with, let's say, the how often there's an error or an incorrect step in the computer program, one way or another, whatever the cause of it.
Yes, that's
correct. Okay, so then, see, when you write a step in a program, it's either correct or it's not correct. In what you call a long program, there's errors in it or there isn't. Whether or not you found them is sort of irrelevant.
Well,
the question is, what causes a mistake in a program? It isn't that the program failed. It's that it either was written correctly or wasn't written correctly.
Yes, but the chance of exercising a path where you will come upon a residual error is going to vary with data inputs and vary with the way that you're stressing the program. This is, in fact, why I feel that we're justified in taking a probabilistic approach.
I didn't argue that so much. There is some problem here in rigorously defining all the aspects.
Entirely agreed.
We have time for one more question in the middle, please. Please come up to the microphone and identify yourself and your organization.
I'm Vince Henley from IBM Endicott, and I must say that I'm glad to see a paper like this has been written in this symposium. I've been coming for a number of years, and it's about time somebody addressed software. My job is software reliability, so I have a couple of questions to ask. First of all, you said you would address the idea of corrections and functional improvements introducing additional errors, and I didn't see you do that.
We had commented that this was a datum that we had. From the data sources from which we obtained data, we found that there were roughly 17 instructions, and this is an average smeared across the data, 17 instructions changed per programmatic change. Now, we need more data on that, clearly.
Okay, you don't really have any idea to the chaining effect of, say, functional changes or say, corrective changes?
Well, it'd be a strong function of the program you were talking about, of course.
Well, that's true, of course. Another question I have several here. Did you find any effect on your various supervisory programs on the number of customers, say, using the program? This would have an effect on the speed with which you found the number of residual errors.
Clearly, the answer is yes, and further, it made a difference as to what sort of applications they had been put out into.
Mm-hmm. What about speed of the, throughput of the software system involved? Did you find this to be a variable?
We did not address that. The equipment is, as I pointed out, third-generation equipment. We're not talking about small programs. I did not try to separate that variable out.
All right. Also, you mentioned the definition, which I don't think you defined, the number of instructions vital to program success. I don't think any programmer would write any instructions that he didn't think were vital to program success, so how do we go about defining that?
I must completely disagree with you. It's been my experience with at least government agencies that we spend a tremendous amount of time in doing cleanup and formatting type work in particular that doesn't fall in that category. I won't try to comment on IBM stuff.
Well, I'm sure we're just as guilty of it as anybody, but are you referring to things which are done just for aesthetic purposes, the printouts and that sort of thing,
yes,
as being non-vital to program success?
Okay.
And, in other words, if you missed a header on a particular program printout, you might have a little difficulty in reading it, but assuming you were familiar with the output, you'd still get all your information without the header, as long as the data still came out.
As long as it wasn't on a check or something like that.
That's right.
One other last comment. I think you made a comment on the cost of software versus hardware. I think in many cases you'll find that the software cost is now very much in excess of the hardware cost. It's about time we address that.
Yes. I would like to ask further questions, and I see one in the back. Would you please write it down and save it for the formal question and answer session, where we'll address specific questions that we didn't have time for now, as well as overall questions? The platform stage does not meet the back of the room. There's so much room, and I found it. That's a management error. And if I found the guy, I'd talk to him. Our next speaker will be Mr. R.B. Mullock. Dick Mullock is going to speak on software reliability engineering. Dick's background includes his Bachelor of Science in Engineering degree from Stanford in 1941, a career during World War II that involved weapon system work for the armed forces. In 1948, he received a master's degree in business administration from Stanford. During the Korean War, he served as a liaison representative between the armed forces and Sandia. His career then involved the Joy Manufacturing Company, Consolidated Electrodynamics, Aerojet General, General Telephone, Sylvania. It's clear he's had a varying background. Presently, and since 1967, he's been with Lockheed Missiles, and his area of interest is software reliability.
The purpose of this paper is to induce one or more of you to to get into software reliability. And we're hoping that perhaps we can show you that there are some things that you can do today and some things that you might want to do tomorrow. Let's leave the lights on. I think you can all see these slides without. That's good. Now let's get going. The definitions used by the previous speaker are pretty well hold for what I have to talk about. And I just want to go over a few things, so we're talking about the same general area. This paper is concerned primarily and almost exclusively with executive or system software as contrasted with applications. In other words, it's the executive system and not the Fortran program that we're talking about. The fault types we might recognize in a system are loops or deadlocks or confusion. And perhaps I better explain confusion. That might be where the system has conflicting information. It's waiting for a tape to rewind and the tape is already rewound. Or it's waiting for an input, it already has it. Or it's looking for a program in core and it hasn't been called in. These types of things can tie the system up, and if the program is vital, you're dead. These are errors that are not the fault of a single instruction, usually. They're the fault of the logic or the path that has been taken through the logic. The deadlocks is a traffic jam, which can happen in a system. For example, if you put two programs in at the same time, and each of them require two resources, and program A gets resource 1, and program B gets resource 2, and they both need both of them before they can complete, they can just deadlock. Each one is holding up the other. Fault causes can be generally grouped as clerical, logical, and numerical. And the clerical ones, these are key punch errors, sometimes called mechanical errors, are usually pretty quickly eliminated. And we won't deal any further with those, except to recognize them as a nuisance. The numerical errors we don't worry about in the system area because essentially there's no floating point computations, there's no convergence, and we leave that area to the numerical analysts. And by the way, one of the things we tried to do in this paper is put in a lot of references. And I think you'll find that if you do take a look in the back of the book where the paper is, this may be the only worthwhile thing in the paper. It's the only thing I didn't write. It reminds me, this is the second time I've been up here trying to talk about software reliability. And the previous time was in Chicago. It was the last day and the last hour of the last day. And there are about five of us here who finished. Hopefully, we'll do a little bit more today and show some of the things that can be done. The problems that a programmer gets into are mistakes, but they're very subtle mistakes, and these mistakes are created by the pressure that's put on him. And they're schedules, costs, he doesn't have enough core to do what he wants to, timing problems that have already been mentioned, and a thing that I call programmer competition. One programmer may be trying to outdo another in elegance or something like this, and perhaps not getting at things. These all lead to the fact that perhaps in software, like in hardware, there needs to be a reliability engineer on the scene at all times so that he can provide on-the-spot feedback. This is what you folks do in hardware. Through various techniques, design review and others, you provide feedback to the hardware designer. The software designer, sometimes called a software engineer, sometimes called a programmer, sometimes a system analyst, he has the same need, but he's not welcoming you at all. He's back 10 years ago or 20 years ago when you weren't welcome. The environment that the programmer works in can be important. This first thing here is a little formula on turnaround time that can be handy. It's in the book, but it points out that if you try to run a system at capacity, it's going to run pretty slow as far as the individual is concerned. And this means that the programmer may have to work on two or three programs in the same time, same day, in order to get enough work done. He's in order to avoid waiting all the time for output. He needs good debugging facilities, a means whereby he can get at the program and run it in real time and watch it on a scope or on a terminal. He needs good printout facilities so he can get at his variables. He may want to look at things in terms of his language rather than the system language. Documentation is one of the most important things. Without documentation, your system engineers will never know whether the software has been designed the way they expected it to be designed. I once looked at some programming that had been done on an accounting system, and the guy was preparing his doing a trial balance by computer, and he'd been told that the trial balance was proved correct if these two totals were equal. He made them equal. They were all both printed out of the same place in CORE. You've got to get into some of these things and find out what's going on. Good inter-programmer communication can be very important so that each one knows what the other's going on. The history is full of instances where systems have been done over and over and over. There's probably one example of a large system which was done once and it worked, and that was the Cambridge Monitor System control program. 11 guys did that, and it's a very successful system. It runs several languages and will give anybody a virtual computer to play with. Other systems, they get too large. They can't talk to each other. We had a cost hint here of the cost of programming, but IBM has made public the fact that they're spending $50 million a year on their operating system, known as OS, just keeping it up. This is a lot of money. And a good part of this is because it's so hard to communicate in large groups. So we want to provide good communication, and this requires a good organization. And an organization that has been designed by software people and not an engineer who decided, well, it ought to be structured this way. The documentation to provide visibility so that everybody knows what's going on, not just the programmers. Some of the things that the reliability engineer can do is detailed things. The first one I've called transportability. Quite often software is written and the machine that the programmer uses to test out his code is not the same machine where it's going to be run. And this can create a host of problems. The word size can be different if the computers are changed, but that's a pretty serious one. In general, you'll find that there's just a little bit of difference in hardware, or the interrupts are handled a little bit differently, or the speed of something coming in is a little different, and things don't work. You take a company like IBM that has to design software to meet the world, their software may work fine for one place and be all kinds of trouble in another. This is because it is not fully transportable. Now, I've seen some IBM installations that are outstanding. A 91 that runs a machine cycle every 40 nanoseconds, run for a week without an error, either hardware or software for that matter. It can be excellent. Now, that same software at another installation may not work quite as well. Simulation has already been mentioned. I just repeat that if you can simulate what you are doing and simulate it well, you can do a hell of a lot better job of getting troubles early. The interfaces, we've heard talk about modular programming, but if you can design something just like you would a printed circuit card that has the least number of wires going from one card to the next, the least communication from one module to the next, then it becomes easier to test, because you have a very few input and output parameters that you can test at the module level. But if you have all kinds of crosstalk between the modules, then you have something that is practically untestable. The same thing as you'd run into in hardware if you had a lot of redundancy inside the box, but only one lead in, one lead out. You'd never know whether redundancy still existed. You couldn't test it. You can have software that can't be tested. Now, don't let me lead you astray that there are a lot of analogies between software and hardware. I think we have some similar names. About the only analogies that really hold are the ones that deal with people. the designers. You have the same problems with them, whether they're designing hardware or software. One point in error monitoring, we have lots of errors and we have error escape routines, but it seems that many programs have error routines that have never been tested because the error has never been simulated or it's just never happened. This can give a lot of trouble, but essentially what the reliability engineer needs to do is to go in and see that every error technique has been properly tested. Changes are expensive. Changes cause errors. And changes made late cause errors that are very difficult to recover from. It's possible in software to pre-plan for changes and actually design it so that a change can be put in with a minimum of trouble. All too often, these changes are known, but they're not programmed for. The reliability engineer can quite easily go in and determine now what changes are going to have to be made when this goes to the next installation or the next job and see that that is designed in at the same time the original software is written. So the hazard of a field change is avoided. Without getting into things too deeply, I think we all recognize that computer programs are mathematical objects. They can be completely described mathematically. These fellows listed up here and many others have done work at the application level in proving the correctness of individual programs. And this might be a sorting program or a program to calculate the factorial of a number. This work is progressing, but it'll be a long time before we can use it. One fellow at Stanford is now working at the systems level in proving a system correct. He's with the French AEC as just a temporary student. It appears that about 5 years from now he'll have his thesis out. Then maybe we can take a look at it. But as far as treating them with closed mathematics, that's a long way away yet. There are, however, some mathematical techniques that we can use. And one thing that I like to look at is how ready is the system for use. And if we'll think for a moment, just a system that you and I might want to submit a Fortran program to, we need to consider the reliability, availability, just like we would of any other system. Two other things can be considered and have quite a bit of value, and that's how much of the software in that system has actually been tested, and how well was it tested? How effectively was it tested? And let's chase these four statistics through. The reliability, it's old hat. We're using an exponential model. It isn't a good model. It's the only one I have. I've got data to prove it's wrong. But if you can come up with a better one, please let us know. Failures group. They group quite consistently. I mean, one day you may have three or four crashes for one cause, and then you may go a week without that same thing occurring. And we've been able to prove that within all reasonable statistical confidence that it's not exponentially distributed. But what can you do about it? Take a larger time period and let it average out. Availability, the old formula. Percent tested. As far as I know, only one large computer manufacturer has delivered an operating system that they know has been tested completely, and that was IBM's OS release 20.2, as far as I know. I don't have any documentation on this. From looking at other software, the detailed code, we've always been able to find instructions that have never been tested. In other words, if they'd been tested once, they would have shown to have been an error. It took IBM 20 releases, 20 issues of their OS before they got to this point. It was a big effort. What needs to be done is to make a bitmap in core that represents every instruction in the program and set the bit when you use that instruction. It's slow, it's time-consuming, but it pays dividends. And just keep writing test programs until you've written one gigantic test program that tests the whole system. That doesn't mean you've tested every path. All it means is that you've looked at every part. something that you'd probably do anyway in hardware. The effectiveness of testing is difficult to assess. A gal by the name of Lucille Diamond, who's talked at this meeting before, and another fellow by the name of Bob Blay, he's a Lockheed guy, got the idea that if you looked at the fleas that you caught and then went after the fleas again in another way and found out how many you caught that time, you could probably guess how many were left. And this is kind of that type of approach. What's left as a function of what you found. And I think if you stumble through the arithmetic like I did, it's really quite simple. You just make an assumption, and if the assumption isn't right, you change it until you get some figures that agree with the data you have. In hardware, we've been able to show that good testing will catch 90% of the errors. In other words, you're making an order of magnitude improvement for every different kind of test. The first time you mow your lawn this way, you mow almost all of the lawn. When you go across, you're mowing it differently. I'm not talking...